transformers. That's the title or the description that's often given to Hindu intellectuals in the 19th century and early 20th century. There's a few difficulties I find with that. I sort of used it here, but they're perhaps not reformers in the sense that we generally think of reformers. In some cases, these figures are really more founders of new religious systems rather than reformers of existing religious traditions, as we'll see today. This period is often also called the Hindu Renaissance, which is a term I really don't like. I don't think it's the parallels with the Western Renaissance is too clear or too strong. I mean, there's some parallels, but as we'll see, but I don't think that really just it's really applies here. But in any case, it's in the 19th century and early 20th century, there's a lot happening intellectually in India, mainly in North India, mainly in Bengal, largely due to, or primarily due to the contact with the West. The European nations started to trade with India from, say, the late 15th century onwards. There's a lot of trade that is happening between European nations or powers and the East, and particularly India. The Dutch are there, the Danish are there, the Spanish are there, the French are there, and a little later the British come into the picture as well. The British are actually fairly late. They missed the boat initially, and by the time they start trading extensively with India, the other powers have already very strongly established themselves. And though we now think of the contact between Europe and India as primarily being between the British Empire and India, that's only something that really develops a little later. And it is the most significant contact, but it's the British are late on the scene, and it takes a little while before they actually take over. And when they do in a very very impressive way, a very rapid way, and a very powerful way. But from the second millennium AD, there's a Muslim presence that arrives in North India. And you have a series of Muslim kingdoms or empires, which culminates into the big empire of the Mughals, with Akbar and people like, the last great one being Aurangzeb, who's perhaps likely not. But the Mughal Empire was very, very powerful, although it initially is located primarily in the north of India. And that's as far as its empire extends. By the end of the 17th century, it reaches almost the entire. It covers almost the entire subcontinent, and it's only a little part of the south of India that is not under the control of the Mughal Empire. But the Mughal Empire collapses in the beginning of the 18th century. And due to various reasons, one of which being just political instability and it deteriorates from within rather than due to external forces. And when that happens, there's the British kind of are at the right place at the right time, and they manage to step in and take advantage of this political chaos that arises and sort of gradually take over the north of India. Initially, the British presence in India is through something called the East India Company. It had a political side to it, but it was really meant to be a trade system that facilitated trade between East and West. But by the mid-19th century, it becomes very much political in nature, and the East India Company kind of dissolves, and you get the British Raj, the British rule of India. When this happens, when you suddenly have this strong British presence in India, and before that you had the presence of other nations as well, there's something that happens that's very significant, which is the exchange of ideas between East and West. We've seen some of this already a little bit earlier, where you have a strong Muslim influence, which from the Indian perspective is sort of a Western influence. The sons that we looked at last week, people like Kabir and Namdev and so on, which have a Sufi Islamic influence. But when the British come, there's something there's a stronger change that happens, and there's various scholars have thought, have given reasons why that's the case. Some say it's because of the political superiority and political, sort of greater political power of the British at that time, of the more advanced technology that they bring, and so on. But in any case, the influence is really both ways. The earliest scholars of Indian thought were people that were employed by the East India Company, and they started studying the Indian thought and actually liked it quite a bit. At that time, there's the Romantic movement in the West is really thriving, and it sort of ties in with that. But what these earliest scholars liked about India was not the religion of the Indians at it in their time, but rather what they saw as the origin of it all, and the sort of the golden age of Hindu thought, which was the Vedas and the Upanishads, which they really admired and really liked, and sort of saw some of their own romantic ideas sort of read them into those texts. They did not like polytheism, and they did not like the temple worship that was very prevalent in India in the 19th century. They really did not like the idea of caste and the practices associated with caste. And so a lot of contemporary Hinduism or Hindu practices they really did not like. So things like pilgrimage, which are centered around images in temples, they could not relate to, and so on. But what they did like was the early stuff, the Vedas and the Upanishads in particular, and so they bring that back to Europe, and in Europe, these texts get translated fairly early on. There's a number of texts that are translated in the late 18th century. You have the first translation of the Bhagavad Gita. And interestingly enough, also Dharmashastras, which are books about how to conduct yourself in the world, which they translated because they used them for legal reasons, and they kind of turned them into law books in India, so they could apply, when it comes to religious matters or marriage, they could apply the local laws. So for Hindus, that would be Dharmashastra. For the Muslims in India, that was the Sharia, and so on. But that perception of Indian thought by the Western scholars is very significant for the development of Hindu thought in that period, because what we'll see happens is that a number of these Hindu intellectuals were in the early generation not, but later on, as the British established schools, a lot of these Hindu intellectuals receive a British education, receive an English education, and imbibe certain ideas from the English. And one of them is precisely this, a real just like for temple worship, for caste, for Puranic texts, which deal with all the temple worship and the deities that are venerated in temples and so on, and a love for the Vedas and the Upanishads. And so there's a strong move back to the Vedas, which for centuries by that time have been, they've always had a very high authority, but there's very little engagement with them in classical Hindu thought. With the Upanishads more, but with the Vedas itself, there's not much engagement. But here there's a move back to these texts and sort of establishing a religious system based on these ideas. And what I want to do is look at three main movements that arise, which are two of which, well, one of which is practically dead, or is sort of, it still survives, but it's not very influential anymore. One is still alive in some ways, but has lost, is not as powerful as it used to be, or not as influential as it used to be. And the third one, which is very much alive today. And we'll see there are some things that unite them. There's certain ideas that we will see permeate these three schools, or these three movements that arise. But they each have their own very distinct character. And the first person I want to look at this. This person here, and this is not on the handout. This is from a course I was giving earlier on this period. This is Ram Mohan Roy. Ram Mohan Roy is an interesting figure. He was born in 1772, so the late 18th century, in a Brahmin family in Bengal. But this is before there's still a Muslim rule in Bengal at the time. And Ram Mohan Roy's family, although they're Hindu Brahmins, for centuries, they've been working at the Mughal court, at the Muslim court, and Ram Mohan Roy is sort of on that career path as well. And so he receives a Persian education, and later he starts studying Sanskrit in Benares. But his first education is a Persian education because he was going to work at the court. And he's very different from the other thinkers we'll look at, because his exposure to Western thought is not something he picked up in school, because he didn't go to an English school, but is something that was really self-taught. And he gets very interested in Western thought, and he himself starts reading. He starts learning English, he starts studying English, and then starts reading English texts. And he was trained to work for the Muslim court, at the Muslim court, but by the time he's sort of age, the Muslim court has disappeared and the East India Company has appeared. And so he ends up working for the East India Company, and that's where his exposure to Western ideas really takes off. He retired fairly early, the last 20 years of his life, he stopped working for the East India Company, and he retired. He was fairly wealthy at that time, and he devotes all his energy to religious topic, or to explain or teach his religious ideas. And he dies in 1833 in Bristol, in England, and he's actually buried in Bristol. He came over to England, invited by the Unitarians, and gave lectures here, and then he got sick and died fairly unexpectedly in Bristol, and initially was buried in somebody's backyard because he was not a Christian, so couldn't be buried in a churchyard. But then later they moved his grave, and it's now in Bristol somewhere, and there's a statue of him in Bristol. But that sort of little anecdote is actually very significant. It's very revealing for Ram Mohan Roy's ideas. He starts a movement called the Brahma Samaj. The Samaj is the assembly, and Brahmo is the the Bengali way of saying Brahman, the assembly of God, you could say. And he, which is an organization he founds, and he, which he establishes to express his religious ideas, and his ideas are monotheistic. He's a staunch monotheist, and he believes in a deity that is utterly transcendent to this world, and kind of gets very close to a deistic sort of theology, where God is sort of beyond this world and doesn't really interact that much with this world, and sort of, you know, the world was created, but then it's kind of on its own in a way. But
do you think that was something that he picked up while he was working for the... I was wondering what exactly it means that he was exposed to Western ideas, but I don't think that the people who worked for the East India Company somewhere in Bengal were talking about Voltaire all that much, or were they?
Well, you'd be surprised, actually. A lot of the people that worked for the East India Company were very highly educated people. Mm-hmm. And the East India Company had... I mean, you know, it sort of had its trade side to it, but on the other hand, the earliest Indologists, the earliest scholars of Hinduism that came to India came mainly through the East India Company, and they were judges working for the East India Company. And that's why they start translating Dharma Shastras and so on, so they can use this in their legal system and in their court system. And so they were actually highly educated people. They were people that were very... it's like the, what's his name, William Jones, who's sort of one of the earliest, he translated the Bhagavad Gita, he's the first person to translate the Bhagavad Gita into English. Before he traveled to India, I mean, he was very well schooled in Western thought, and he'd studied Hebrew, he'd studied Latin, he'd studied Arabic, he'd studied Greek, he knew a number of the sort of contemporary languages, German, English, French, and so on. He'd already studied Chinese, but sort of started studying Chinese and Persian, and then when he got to India, he started studying Sanskrit. So this is a person who's very highly educated, and these are the people that they were exposed to. Because these people, they started working with upper caste Hindus to learn, you know, how things work and sort of get them involved in the court system and so on. I mean, like William Jones, he was a judge, but he had a group of Brahmins that he used as sort of advisors and consultants and so on. And so there's a lot of exchange of ideas that takes place there. And someone like Ram Mohan Roy particularly, I mean, he meets the people at the East India Company, but then he himself starts reading a lot himself. He's very much sort of an autodidact. And starts teaching himself, starts reading a lot of Western literature and so on. Well, yeah, that's the question, of course. You know, what's the? You know, he receives a Persian education, which is a Muslim education, and then has a Sanskrit education as well. And then is exposed to Western thought, so it's kind of all three strands meet in him and sort of influence him. He was actually someone that was very much in favor of the British occupation. I didn't give you this in the handout, but he says this is his comment on the British in India. He says conquest is very rarely an evil when the conquering people are more civilized than the conquered. Because the former bring to the latter the benefits of civilization. So the conquering nation is more civilized, it's good, because they bring civilization. India requires many more years of English domination so that she may not have many things to lose while she's reclaiming her political independence. And so he wants political independence, but he says actually that the presence of the British is good because it will make us stronger and we have so much to learn from it. And that's his attitudes towards it. And so there's a desire for you know, developing an independence and developing a strong Hindu identity, but he sees a lot of good in what the West has to offer. The Brahma Samaj is a very interesting organization because it was sort of set up in that, you know, they would meet once a week on a Sunday, and their services, the way they were held were, was there would be a sermon, and they would sing hymns, very, very Protestant. And the hymns were mainly hymns, either passages from Vedic texts that they translated, or hymns that they themselves, Ram Mohan Roy and his follower and his sort of, you know, entourage themselves composed. And but Ram Mohan Roy's idea, and there's a strong influence of Christianity on him, particularly of Unitarian Christianity. Well, of course, there's a question to what extent Unitarianism is really Christianity, but there's a strong influence of Unitarianism on him. He was exposed to, you know, a lot of his friends were Unitarian people, and his idea was that, in essence, all religions teach the same. And so Hinduism and Christianity and Islam and so on, in their essence, they're all the same. But what has happened is that people have built up systems around them that distort that true teaching. And so he looks at Christianity and says, well, the idea of the Trinity and the whole Trinitarian thing, so, you know, this is all borrowed from Unitarian thought, you know, all the idea of the Trinity, that's sort of something that was later added to it, and that really distorts the true teachings of Jesus. When he looks at Hindu traditions, he says, well, all this temple worship, all this pilgrimage, all these caste practices, and so on, these are all things that have been added over the centuries that have corrupted the real teachings of the Vedas and the Upanishads, and so we have to strip it all of these things and go back to the Vedas and the Upanishads. And when we look at the real core of both religious traditions, Christianity and Hinduism, they're the same. There's no difference between them. And so what Jesus would have thought would be the same as what is found in the Upanishads and so on. Ram Mohan Roy, in a number of places, he sometimes admitted that he thinks Christianity has preserved the original teachings better than Hindu traditions have, and so that there's more distortion that occurred in the Hindu traditions. But still, he so he says, therefore, you know, I might refer more to Jesus and so on, which he did quite frequently. He does see himself as a Hindu in some ways, and he starts translating the Upanishads with commentaries on them into English, and he starts writing on Upanishadic themes and so on. And so there is a strong Hindu side to it, but there's a very strong Christian influence on it as well. Ram Mohan Roy's attitude towards caste is very complex, actually. In the early Brahmo Samaj, there was actually, you know, you had the hall or where the services were held, and sort of in the middle there was a curtain that was hung there, and on one side of the curtain were all the Brahmins, and on the other side of the curtain were the non-Brahmins. And the reason for that was that the Brahmins were the ones that were chanting the Upanishads during their services. And traditionally speaking, if you're not from the upper three classes, if you're a Brahmin, a Kshatriya, or a Vaishya, you cannot study the Veda, and so which includes the Upanishads. You cannot recite them, you cannot study them. And so initially, he had this strong segregation in his system. But later, a friend of him questions that and says, well, aren't you against these sort of practices? So what are you doing here? And then he says, actually, you're right, let's get rid of it. And so he abolishes that. But one thing he's very, very influential with, and he's very concerned with this, is the rights of women. And he's a strong advocate for women's, sort of the betterment of women in Hindu society. And particularly, he's appalled by the practice of sati, where a widow can choose to be sort of burnt with her husband. And in, what is it, 1829 or something like that, the British passed the famous Sati Act, where sati is declared illegal. Ram Mohan Roy was one of the main people behind that. He was politically very active and pushed the British to get this through. And so that's a lot of his writings are about this and are about the education for women and so on. And so that's sort of his social message there. The Brahma Samaj after Ram Mohan Roy is taken over by a person called Devendranath Tagore, who is the father of Rabindranath Tagore, the Nobel Prize poet, the famous poet. So Devendranath Tagore was the father of Rabindranath Tagore. And he kind of continues this trend, but he Devendranath Tagore, Ram Mohan Roy was a very, very rational person in many respects. And so his idea of religion is a very rational system. It's a system, you think about God. It's a very intellectual system, rather than a very devotional system. It's about through reason you can come to understand the nature of God. You can come to understand the nature of God through the careful study of the world around you, of nature, and but it's the emphasis is really on rational thought. Devendranath Tagore is very different. He has a strong, this is all happening here in Bengal, where the presence of the British is the strongest. The Calcutta here is the later becomes the capital of the British Empire in India, the British Raj. But this is, of course, the area where the Chaitanya Vaishnava tradition has flourished for centuries. Devendranath Tagore is someone who comes again from a Brahmin family and is really very strongly influenced by this Vaishnava bhakti, and he brings that to the Brahma Samaj, and it's sort of the Brahma Samaj under his leadership becomes a bit more of a devotional movement, and the hymns he writes are less intellectual and more devotional. More about emotions than about the intellect, compared to Ram Mohan Roy. But then things get a little messy in the Brahma Samaj, and there's a young person who joins the Brahma Samaj, whose name is Keshav Chandra Sen. And Keshav Chandra Sen is a really, really interesting figure, because he's sort of a young guy when he joins it. Devendranath Tagore, he's the leader at the time, and Devendranath Tagore is an older person, sort of in his 50s or so. Keshav Chandra Sen is in his 20s when he joins, and he's this really passionate and very self-confident person that joins, and he doesn't like certain things, and he thinks there's too much bhakti going on, and so on. And later he sort of splits off and starts his own movement called the Church of the New Dispensation. And he's particularly interesting because he really, Devendranath Tagore doesn't care much about Christianity, actually, like Ram Mohan Roy did. So he's sort of, he's more permeated with the Vaishnava Bhakti from Bengal. But Keshav Chandra Sen goes back to the Christianity Ram Mohan Roy loved to such an extent that I gave you a passage there, which is pretty famous from him on page 4. You have a passage there from Ram Mohan Roy, for instance, on Christianity, where Ram Mohan Roy talks about the Christianity, where he's basically saying, I like Christianity, I don't like the missionaries, what are the missionaries doing here? We have a religion too. And so it's just, it has been distorted. So, but then the passage below there you have, this is Keshav Chandra Sen talking to Max Müller, who is probably one of the biggest Indologists in his days. And he says, suppose that 50 years hence people found out that I was a disciple of Christ, what would be the harm? Only were I to profess myself a Christian now, all my influence would be gone at once. And this is sort of a comment he makes to someone in private, to Max Müller. But I think that betrays his interest quite strongly. The Keshav Chandra Sen is much more of a... sometimes you read, if you read his writings and you read his sermons, he really gave sermons, they're very Christian. And it's sometimes hard to figure out, is this Christianity, is this Hinduism? And it's because he comes to the idea that... actually, he sort of takes the Unitarian idea of Ram Mohan Roy, that all religions in their written their essence are one, to a new level, and says, well, actually, all religions are one. And his Church of the New Dispensation that he founds is a movement where he says, you know, I teach the new dispensation. The old dispensation is that, you know, people exclude themselves and they say, we're this and you're that, and we're Christian, you're Hindu, we're European, you're Indian, and so on. I'm Brahmin, you're Kshatriya. And he says, actually, my new school is that we're all part of the same family, and we all believe in the same thing, even though we may express it very differently. That's an idea he gets from a person called Ramakrishna Paramahamsa. I'll say a bit about him in just a moment, who was a mystic who lived in the area of Calcutta at his time, and that was really Ramakrishna Paramahamsa's teachings. And Kesha Chandrasekhar kind of takes that and just expresses it in a very Christian way. Kesha Chandrasekhar was also someone who was very active in Europe. He travels in Europe, gives lectures organized by Unitarian organizations, and so he travels to England. Now, the other movement that arises is a movement called the Arya Samaj, the assembly of the Aryans, which has some similarities to the Brahma Samaj, in that the founder of that, Dayananda Saraswati, you have his name somewhere on the handout, Dayananda Saraswati is also one of these persons that says, well, let's go back to the Vedas. He was born in a Brahmin family of Shaivas, and at a very early age, he writes about his own life and in his autobiographical writings. He mentions that when he was a child, there's a Shivaratri, which is a Shaiva festival, he's spending the night in the temple during the celebrations. While everyone is asleep, he's a little boy and he's still awake, and he sort of goes to the altar, the shrine where the Shivalinga is, the image of Shiva, and he sees that there's rats crawling over the Shivalinga and that there's rats eating the sweets that were offered to the Shivalinga, and he loses all faith in the worship of images, and he says, what kind of a god is this whose food is stolen by rats, and you know, rats sort of urinate on top of this image. And so he loses all faith in that, and he breaks with the tradition of his family and starts looking for a guru, finds a guru, gets initiated, becomes a sannyasi, and then starts teaching his ideas, which is the same thing, all the Puranic ideas, the temple worship and so on. These are all corruptions of the real teachings of the Vedas. And for him, less the Upanishads. The Brahma Samaj is more the Upanishads and the Vedas. He's more the Vedas and sort of the Upanishads too. And he was a person that was very influential in his time, and liked by many of his followers. He starts a very strong movement, but that was hated by most of his opponents, because he was a person who was very vigorous in debate, and he sort of his style is he would mock people. So he wrote, his main work is called the Satyagraha Prakash, the illumination on the truth, on the real truth. And the first half of it is really an exposition of his teachings. The second half is where he has a go at every other religious tradition that he knows, including the Christianity, and where he goes sort of through the entire Bible and points out inconsistencies and mocks the teachings of that. But he develops a very strong anti-temple system, and he says all these temple rituals his reasoning is, if you say that God is present everywhere, why should I worship in the temple? I can worship him anywhere. He starts a religious practice that is based on Vedic rituals, which he sees the Vedas not as a polytheistic text, but rather as a monotheistic text, where all the names of the gods refer to the one true God. And Yeah, he's much more than the Brahma Samaj. His is really a missionary movement, aimed not towards the British, but really towards the Indian people themselves. And the Arya Samaj becomes and is still very famous for a Shuddhi ritual, a purification ritual they offer, that if your ancestors were Hindus, then or even if not, and you want to become a Hindu, you can undergo this rite, and then you're officially a Hindu. Ironically, nowadays, this is a movement that is condemns temple worship. In order to get into some temples as a non-Indian, they say, well, if you undergo the ritual of the Arya Samaj, then we'll consider you a Hindu, and then you can come into the temple, which is very ironic, since the Arya Samaj doesn't care about temple worship. The Arya Samaj is still very strong in some areas of India, particularly in the Punjab, but is particularly influential in the political sphere. The Arya Samaj, from the Arya Samaj, develop a number of political Hindu nationalist movements that aim for the independence of India and the establishment of a Hindu state. And so Dayanand Saraswati himself was very political some of his writings are very political, and so his influence is still very strongly felt in those Hindu nationalist movements that are quite strong today. Let's keep it at that for the Arya Samaj. And then the third movement I want to look at is the Ramakrishna Mission, which is a movement that was founded by Swami Vivekananda, who was a Bengali boy who got in touch with a person called Ramakrishna Paramahamsa. Ramakrishna Paramahamsa was a priest at a Kali temple in near Kolkata, and so you can sort of see Ramakrishna as a priest in a temple, which is very different from all the other people we've looked at, where they all condemn temple worship. Ramakrishna is very different. He's a priest in the temple, and he has these ecstatic visions of the goddess Kali, and it's really, he becomes a religious figure based on these visions and based on his experiences that he has. And a lot of people start coming to him, asking him for teachings, and his influences are very interesting. He's sort of a Shakta, comes from a lineage, he's a priest in a Kali temple, so there's a strong influence of goddess worship on him, and particularly tantric goddess worship. His life story, his official life story, says that he was initiated into tantric practices by a female ascetic, but then he was also had a strong Vedantic side to him as well, and he kind of mixes the two, and the two really mix in Swami Vivekananda to create something that's sort of kind of neither and both and everything and nothing and, in a way. But Ramakrishna's teachings, the central teaching of him is that all religions are one, and his view of all religions are one is very different from the views of Ram Mohan Roy or of Keshav Chandra Sen, whereas they say all religions in their essences are one, and so we have to strip it all of all its corruptions and its additions that men have added to it, and then when we go to the source of it, we find that all religions are one. Ramakrishna's view of all religions are one is that all religions as we know them now are really all leading to the same goal. And so Ram Mohan Roy would not say that if you're a Hindu priest in a temple or a Trinitarian Christian, that you're really embarking on the same spiritual path and you will obtain the same goal. But he says if you're a Unitarian Christian and you're a Unitarian Hindu, if you want, then you're actually doing the same thing. Ramakrishna says, no, all religions are the same. They're just different ways of looking at the same idea. And so whether you're following a Hindu path, a sort of an orthodox Hindu path that involves temple worship, or you follow a really left-hand tantric path that involves, you know, sort of the impure items that are used in ritual, or whether you're a Christian or a Muslim of whatever flavor you can think of, that everyone will reach the same goal because God is one and is just perceived that and understood differently from different sort of perspectives. And this is really an idea that comes, that's an extension from a Shakta notion. Shaktism it's not really an ism, it's not really a school that develops. It's a tradition or a group of traditions that focuses on the worship of the goddess, but that really takes off in the way we know it nowadays in Bengal, around the time that the Muslim empire collapses. The Muslim empire, as long as the Muslim empire is very strong, the Vaishnava traditions in Bengal flourish. When the Muslim empire sort of wanes and its power decreases, what happens is the zamindars, the local landlords, become more powerful. Most of these were actually Shaktas, and so with that comes the Shaktism that becomes much more powerful. And in the Shakta view, that develops in Bengal, there's a number of poems. It's mainly expressed in poetry, but if you read these poems, there's a lot of poems that are along the lines of that. You Kali, they're addressed to Kali, to the sort of a fierce form of the goddess. That you sometimes dress as Krishna, and sometimes dress as this god, and sometimes dress as this god, and all these gods are really one, and they're all manifestations of you. And this is a sort of monism where everything is seen to be one, which is very different from Shankara's monism. Shankara doesn't like the idea that all deities are one. He says all deities are ultimately, you know, Brahman, like everything is Brahman. But Shankara would not say that you can worship any deity and you will obtain the same result. He says it's rather the contrary. And he's much more Vaishnava in that. He actually says if you want to attain, you know, if you're on a path to liberation, the deity you should worship is Vishnu, because it's a sattvic deity, it's a deity that is pure and clean and so on. But this Shakta monism that comes in through Ramakrishna into the expressions of modern thought is Ramakrishna extends this to all religions, and so he says it's not just, you know, the different Hindu gods that are really one, but it's all the gods of all the religions are really one.
They're all Kali.
He actually goes beyond that and says that actually Kali is also, it's the ultimate reality is non-dual and has no attributes and is sort of an impersonal force rather than a deity per se.
Isn't he, when he takes it beyond that, isn't he getting quite close to Shankara's monism
though? No, because what Ramakrishna says, Shankara does go beyond all deities, but Shankara is very clear that, for Shankara, there's only one path to that, and that is a path of renunciation and of jnana and of meditation on the Upanishadic truths. For Ramakrishna, it's any path will lead you to the same goal. The image Ramakrishna often uses is, says you have a big house and you have different doors leading into the house. And so you have the big entrance, you know, say you have a palace, you know, you have the main entrance, which is a very grand way. And so that might be the Vedic path. And he says you have a back door that kind of goes by the bathroom. He says that would be the tantric path. But in the end, you all end up in the same room inside. So it doesn't really matter which route you take, you'll get to the same room inside. That's Ramakrishna's idea, which is really not Shankara's idea. Shankara is not so inclusive, Ramakrishna is more of a pluralist, whereas Shankara would be more of an inclusivist. And Vivekananda takes up these ideas from Ramakrishna. Akeshav Chandrasen did too, and then sort of gives it a very Christian twist, sort of a Christian Hindu twist. Vivekananda takes up these ideas from Ramakrishna, adds some Vedanta to it, but again, it's not although most people see him as sort of following Shankara's Vedanta, he's really not following Shankara's Vedanta in many ways. For him, Shankara is again is somebody who's very clear about, you know, there's one path to liberation, and that's, you know, it's the path that he teaches, and scripture is very important for Shankara. It's, you know, the only, he's a Vedantist, and so the only way you can come to knowledge of God, of Brahman, is through the study of the Upanishads, and so the Upanishads are central to his teachings. Vivekananda kind of moves away from that, and he says, no, the main thing, which is based on Ramakrishna's life and teachings, is experience. And so anyone who has a religious experience, their teachings become authoritative. And this allows him to say that, you know, Christian saints had their teachings are authoritative because their experience comes from their teachings come from their experience of God. And so Vivekananda starts translating the Imitation of Christ, the very, you know, the Christian work that's most popular after the Bible, into Bengali, and writes a very interesting introduction to that, where he explains why translating this work, you know, into Bengali for Hindu readers is not sort of a strange thing to do. And the whole idea is that it's based on experience. This person had an experience of God, and therefore his teachings are valid, just as Ramakrishna had an experience, and we learn from his experience. And so it's there's a transcendence of scripture. There's a very good book about this, Anantan and Rambachan, The Limits of Scripture, Vivekananda's Reinterpretation of the Vedas, where Rambachan really looks at this and looks at the way this goes. Vivekananda is very influential in the formation of Hinduism, of sort of a unified vision of Hindu traditions in the West. He travels to the West, without being invited, he travels to the West and decides to try and attend the World Parliament of Religions in Chicago that is held in 1893, and sort of shows up there without any invitation, gets to speak there, and then starts a lecture tour of North America and then later Europe, that where he teaches his ideas, and it's kind of, he was a very charismatic person. He died fairly young. I think he was 42 when he died, but he was very influential, very charismatic. And a person, if you read about his life, he was a person who really knew what he was doing. He was a good PR person, and he was really, really good at it. And he knew what to say to what people. He knew how to appear in certain circumstances to get his message across. And a lot of Hindus today, if you ask them about what they believe and so on, what they'll tell you is largely what Vivekananda was teaching. That the idea that all paths lead to the same goal, it doesn't matter which deity you worship, all deities are manifestations of the one sort of nameless, attributeless God beyond it, which is something that really arises in that period and really arises in the teachings of Ramakrishna and then Vivekananda, who popularizes this. Before that, what you see is there's very strong lineages, very strong sampradayas, schools of thought, where you know, Ramakrishna kind of and Vivekananda say that whether you're a Sri Vaishnava, a follower of Ramanuja, or if you follow Shaiva Siddhanta, or you follow a Vedic path of the Mimamsakas, ultimately it's all the same. And really the difference is that for a Sri Vaishnava, define his you know, identity, he says those actually all don't matter. And so there's a way of engaging with the traditions of the past by silencing the traditions of the past, in a way, and saying that, yes, you know, all these debates that you've had between, you know, Vaishnavas and Advaita Vedantas and Shaivas and so on, they're actually all, you know, they really don't matter, because, you know, you're actually all worshipping the same deity. Ramanuja or Shankara or Madhva or any of the people we've looked at, they wouldn't see it that way. And so there's a way of engaging with the past by cutting it off, basically, and saying, actually, we don't care so much about the past. One final point: Vivekananda was also very much involved in a number of theme that he brought up often is, it was a very political theme, and was also the idea of the necessity of the independence of India and the the British, that the India should gain its independence. And Vivekananda saw that in very religious terms. He said the reason the British have been able to rule us is because we were divided. We were fighting amongst each other, and we were arguing, the Vaishnavas were arguing with the Shaivas and with Shankara's followers and so on. And so we were divided, but if we see we're actually all part of the same thing, we can stand united against the British and actually oppose them and become independent. And so it's a lot of these Hindu intellectuals from that period are very politically active, and that leads, particularly from the Arya Samaj, but not exclusively, leads to the Hindu nationalist movements that we know today, where there's a desire for a Hindu state rather than a secular state, which India is at the moment. Which kind of leads to anti-Muslim views, where the Muslims, they have, I mean, it's kind of the history of India. When India gains independence, the initial idea was that you'd have one country where Hindus and Muslims could live together. Jinnah kind of breaks off and founds East and West Pakistan, which then later become Pakistan and Bangladesh, which is a Muslim state, is founded on Muslim principles. The Hindu nationalists kind of look at, and India becomes a secular state. The Hindu nationalists, they look at the history and say, well, the Muslims got what they want. They have an Islamic state. We want a Hindu state. And so let the Muslims, you know, they go to their Islamic states. I mean, it's a bit simplifying the idea, but that's how they look upon it. But a lot of this comes out of this period with these thinkers, and then changes, of course, as time goes on. Becomes a bit more militant in some forms. But the important thing, just to summarize, of this period is that there's a real, they're not really reformers in the sense that they try to reform existing traditions. There's a sort of, all of these thinkers say, no, let's stop the existing traditions and let's go back to what existed, or what they see as existed, thousands of years before when the Vedas were composed. Let's go back to those, find the real teachings in there, and disregard everything that has developed in South Asia for millennia in terms of temple worship, in terms of pilgrimage practices, in terms of caste issues, in terms of tantric practices. Dhyanan Saraswati, there's a story where the tantric yogic practices talks about nadis, so these channels in the body that sort of channel energy through the body. And the story goes that Dhyanan Saraswati, on one of his wanderings, came across a corpse and decided, oh, let me, cuts open the corpse, does an autopsy on the corpse, and is looking for those veins, nadis in the body, and then doesn't find them and say, this is just all made up. And that's kind of the way they look at these things. And so there's a rejection of everything that existed in their time, and a return to a golden age of the Vedas and the Upanishads in the form of Ramakrishna and Vivekananda. It takes a slightly different shape. There's a rejection of what came before. There's not a rejection of image worship per se, but the image worship, which has up until that point is always seen as, the image is seen as embodying the deity that it venerates, is where now the image is seen as a symbol for the deity unmanifest deity beyond it, and so there's a break with tradition in that sense. The differences of each religious tradition are sort of downplayed, and sort of a strong Shakta monistic idea that is then mixed with some Vedantic ideas, and particularly terminology in the teachings of Vivekananda. And then, of course, there's a whole political dimension to it as well, which we won't have time to get into much.
I think there wasn't there on whether or not Ramakrishna was an avatar. What was Vivekananda's stand on that? Because it seems like it couldn't really have mattered to him all that much.
In Vivekananda system, an avatar is kind of, Ramakrishna actually is seen as an avatar in the Ramakrishna mission. But it's sort of the idea of an avatar in Vivekananda's idea, sort of teachings, is very different from the idea of an avatar before, because for him it's everyone is divine. And whereas in a Vaishnava, where the ideas of the avatars come from in a Vaishnava setting, not everyone is divine, and so the divinity manifests itself in this world in particular forms, and to re-establish dharma, as Krishna says in the Gita. And so it's a very different idea of avatarhood, if you want. For Ramakrishna is seen as an avatar in the sense that he fully realizes his divinity. And so he's an avatar in that sense. He's an embodiment of God because he realizes his God. And we're not an embodiment of God because we have not realized we're God. That's the direction Vivekananda goes with that. But Ramakrishna becomes the focus of a lot of devotion in the Ramakrishna mission. If you go to Ramakrishna mission temples in India, they'll have huge murtis of Ramakrishna and his wife. Sharada, and they're both worshipped, and it's sort of sometimes they're sort of identified as a sort of almost sort of a Shiva Shakti kind of thing, and the divinity, the sort of the male divinity with its feminine energy, sort of its feminine potency,
So is in Vivekananda's reading, would every holy madman be an avatar?
Possibly. I don't know if he says that anywhere, but yeah. There's a passage I gave you in the handout where he talks about temple worship, and he says people want to throw out temple worship, but he says, actually, if I look at Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, who became who he is through the worship of the image in the temple, and so he says, if temple worship, if idolatry, as they called it, can lead to such people as Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, I say, let everyone become an idolater and worship in the temple. And so, but that's a very different idea from an avatar in the classical sense, because you're born an avatar. You don't become something, but you are divinity. The avatars are divinity, not that they become divinity. Whereas he's more, you become divinity. And it's interesting. I mean, Ramakrishna actually claims to be initiated in all the major traditions of the world and all the major religions, and he claims to have attained perfection as a Christian, as a Muslim, as a Hindu, in all Hindu traditions, and so on. And so therefore, it's again from his experience, he says, I've seen that all paths are one. I've attained perfection in all these systems, in all these religions, and I can see that they're all one. And that's where his authority comes from. It's from his own experience of things. Interesting period, because although a lot of these movements like the Arya Samaj and the Brahma Samaj are no longer influential, the way they started thinking about things as it culminated into Vivekananda. Vivekananda is a bit later than these others. Vivekananda is sort of late 1930s, 20th century, whereas all these others are, Keshav Chandra Sen is also later, but the others are all early to mid 19th century. But the way they think about things, the way they start revisiting the past is something that's very much alive today, even if these traditions are not. Of course, the traditional forms of Hinduism are still very much alive as well, and so Ramanuja's tradition is still there, and all these other schools that we looked at this term. they're all still existing, but this is sort of a new thing that